principles included some events which had already happened, others which are occurring in our own time, as well as things yet to come. When it shows that God is always faithful to his promises to Israel, it speaks for our own day, as well as both past and future. We saw that it shows that the throne of God is in the midst of the camp of his people Israel, and that he still recognizes the race of Israel as his servant, whom he has redeemed, and that his temple is still for his people Israel only. Next, we will see that God prophesied that Christianity was to be the work of his people Israel. The 12th chapter of Revelation begins thus, "And there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars." This reference to the sun, moon, and 12 stars is old Israel symbolism, first used in Genesis 37, verses 9 to 11, where the boy Joseph tells his father Israel of his dream. "And he dreamed yet another dream, and told it to his brethren, and said, Behold, I have dreamed a dream more, and behold, the sun and moon and the 11 stars made obeisance to me. And he told it to his father and to his brethren, and his father rebuked him and said unto him, What is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow ourselves down to thee to the earth? And his brethren envied him, but his father observed the saying." Israel himself correctly interpreted the dream. The sun was himself, the moon was his wife, and the 11 stars were Joseph's brothers. Joseph himself made the 12th. So we see in Revelation 12, verse 1, that the symbolic woman, clothed with the sun, having the moon under her feet, and wearing a crown of 12 stars, symbolizes the race of Israel. The following verses make this unmistakably clear. "And she, being with child, cried, travailing in birth, and pained to be delivered. And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and 7 crowns upon his head. And his tail drew the 3rd part of the stars of heaven, and did cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. And she brought forth a man-child, who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up unto God and unto his throne." Now obviously the man-child destined to rule all nations with a rod of iron is Jesus Christ, for Revelation 19, verses 11 to 16 clearly says so. "And I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat upon him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he doth judge and make war. His eyes were as a flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns. And he was clothed with a vesture dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And the armies which were in heaven followed him upon white horses, clothed in fine linen, white and clean. And out of his mouth goes a sharp sword, that with it he should smite the nations. And he shall rule them with a rod of iron, and he treads the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of Almighty God. And he has on his vesture and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords." Again, we know the Israel symbolism to be correct, for it was God's people Israel who gave birth to Jesus Christ. In Romans 9, verses 4 and 5, it speaks of Israelites, to whom pertaineth the adoption, and the glory, and the covenants, and the giving of the law, and the service of God, and the promises, whose are the fathers, and of whom, as concerning the flesh, Christ came. So we see correctly symbolized God's people Israel giving birth to Jesus Christ, while the red dragon stood waiting to devour him as soon as he was born. We know that the Edomite Jew, King Herod, did try to murder Jesus Christ within a few days after his birth by causing all the little children under the age of 2 years in Bethlehem to be murdered. Revelation 12, verse 5 tells us that the woman's child was caught up unto God and to his throne. We know that Jesus Christ, after his resurrection, did ascend to heaven, where he sits on the throne of God. Revelation 12, verses 6, 13 to 17 further confirm the Israel identity. "And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared of God." We know that the peoples of Israel spent centuries migrating through the wilderness to their new homes in northern and western Europe, far beyond the reach of the evil powers of the Babylonian succession of empires, the beast nations. These verses further say, "And when the dragon saw that he was cast into the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child." Yes, this dragon did, from the very beginning, persecute the real Israelites and the Christians. Read these verses of the book of Acts, and you will see who it was that persecuted the early Christians. Acts chapter 4, verses 1 to 3 and 16 to 21. Chapter 5, verses 17, 18, and 27 to 33. Chapter 6, verse 8 to chapter 7, verse 60. Chapter 9, verses 22 and 23. Chapter 12, verses 1 to 4 and 11. Chapter 13, verses 44, 45, and 50. Chapter 14, verses 2 and 19. Chapter 17, verses 5 and 13. Chapter 18, verse 12. Chapter 20, verses 1 to 3. Chapter 21, verse 27. And chapter 23, verse 12. But God never abandoned his people, for Revelation 12, verse 14 tells us, "And to the woman were given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place." Again, this is familiar Israel symbolism, for in Exodus 19, verse 4, God tells his people, "Ye have seen how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you unto myself." But the dragon or serpent people, having failed to kill off the people of Israel, tried yet another weapon against them. For Revelation 12, verses 15 and 16 says, "And the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. And the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood, which the dragon cast out of his mouth." Now Revelation 17, verse 15 tells us, "The waters which thou sawest are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues." So the serpent's new attack was an attempt to destroy God's race by mongrelization with other peoples, which is the worst of all forms of so-called genocide. The great Asiatic invasions under Attila and Genghis Khan were sent to overrun and intermix with the Israelites on their march into Europe, but God did not allow this. They succeeded only in hurrying the migration of Israel, and they were not able to overrun the Israelites. Finally, the identification of Israel is completed in chapter 12, verse 17. "And the dragon was wroth with the woman, and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ." We know that all the real Israelite nations today do have the testimony of Jesus Christ, not Judaism, but Christianity. Call the roll of the great Christian nations of the world today, those who have demonstrated what true Christianity can do for the nation which will wholeheartedly follow it, and you have the list of these Anglo-Saxon Teutonic nations: Britain, Canada, Australia, South Africa, the United States, Germany, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, Holland, and heroic little Finland. These are the outstanding leaders of Christianity today, those who have the testimony of Jesus Christ. There are some pockets of Israel peoples existing as minorities in several other nations, but those I have named are the predominantly Israel nations. Remember that when this was written by John, all but the lifetime of Jesus Christ was still in the future. Prophecy is authenticated by what eventually occurs, and this prophecy has abundantly proven its true inspiration by coming to pass. But it has also proven the Israel identity of the Anglo-Saxon, Scandinavian, and Teutonic peoples. For the Israel symbolism shows that the people who were to do these things are the true Israelites. There is much more in the book of Revelation which will abundantly repay our further study. But I have used up all the time I have for today, so we will continue with this subject in my next broadcast. Today I want to continue with our study of Israel in the book of Revelation. In my last two broadcasts, we were studying the book of Revelation, that mysterious book which has puzzled even great students for many centuries. Obviously, it is a book of prophecy, for it tells us things which were nearly all in the future at the time when the Apostle John wrote it. But these prophecies are nearly all expressed in symbols, and they cannot be correctly understood unless you understand the symbolism used. The whole Bible, including this book, is written about God's people Israel, and other races and nations are mentioned only where they come in contact with Israel. The cannibal savages of Black Africa, the great empires of China and India, the strange civilizations of the Aztecs, Mayas, and Incas on the American continent, all these escaped notice, for they did not affect God's people. But there is frequent mention of the nations of Western Asia and the lands surrounding the Mediterranean Sea, peopled by the beast nations which made up the Babylonian succession of empires, symbolically described in the book of Daniel. For all these people have come in frequent and brutal contact with Israel. So it is in the book of Revelation. As we have already seen in part, much of the symbolism of this book is clearly Israel symbolism and identifies the part to be played by the nations of Israel. However, there is also much animal symbolism identifying the beast nations and the part they will play in history. Much of this book is devoted to Great Babylon. The original city and empire of Babylon had perished before John wrote this book, yet he speaks of Great Babylon in prophecies extending to the end of this age. Therefore, he is speaking of the Babylonian system, which did not end with the fall of the city, but is with us even today. This system completely dominates our present economic and financial system. It forms a powerful portion of our present religious system, and it dominates the political systems of the world today. But even Babylon must be subject to the laws of God when the final judgment comes, as we will see. I could spend weeks covering in detail either the economic or the religious systems of Great Babylon as they exist in the world today, but that is beyond the scope of my present purpose, which is to show the Israel symbolism in this book. So we will content ourselves now with merely noting the existence of Great Babylon in the world today. Chapter 17 deals with religious Babylon in its present form, while chapter 18 covers the Babylonian economic system of today. From the description given, it is easy to identify those of whom it is speaking. Let's examine it. An angel announces the fall of this system and the despair of those who have used it to gain world power. He tells them, "Thy merchants were the great men of the earth, for by thy sorceries were all the nations deceived." And he describes which merchants these are. Those who handle the merchandise of gold and silver and precious stones and pearls, and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet, and all aromatic wood and all manner vessels of ivory, and all manner vessels of most precious wood, and of brass and iron and marble, and cinnamon and odors and ointments and frankincense, and wine and oil and fine flour and wheat, and cattle and sheep, and horses and chariots, and slaves and souls of men. There you have it, gold and jewelry, the clothing industry, luxury items, the drug industry, the liquor industry, wholesale foods, and the meatpacking industry. When you find the people who have largely monopolized these trades today, you have thereby identified the economic side of Great Babylon. But the Babylonian system in all its phases is evil, and has brought misery and grief to the great majority of the people of the world for these many centuries. Therefore, God prophesies its overthrow and judgment in this chapter. We are warned to drive them out, for God tells us, "Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached them to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities." The judgment which we, yes, I said we, are commanded to execute upon Great Babylon is pure Israel law. God commands us in Revelation 18, verse 6, "Reward her even as she rewarded you, and double unto her double according to her works. In the cup which she has filled, fill to her double." Under Israel law, a thief must always restore to his victim at least double what he stole. For example, Exodus 22, verse 9 commands, "For all manner of trespass, whether it be for ox, for ass, for sheep, for raiment, or for any manner of lost thing, which another challengeth to be his, the cause of both parties shall come before the judges, and whom the judges shall condemn, he shall pay double unto his neighbor." Since this is justice to require of God's people, Surely it is the minimum justice to require of Satan's children. Again, we are told in this 18th chapter of Revelation that the evil activities of this great Babylon has been basically responsible for all the murders of the innocent. For it says, "And in her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all that were slain upon the earth." Remember that this book is prophetic of all time, even to the end of this age. So this covers their guilt of the millions of Christians whom they have murdered behind the Iron Curtain in our own day, as well as the other millions slain in the wars which their plots have brought on and are again bringing on. Can we identify them? Yes, for Jesus Christ himself identified them for us. In Matthew 23, verses 29 to 35, he clearly referred to the same thing, saying, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because ye build the tombs of the prophets and garnish the sepulchres of the righteous. And ye say, if we had been in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. Wherefore ye be witnesses unto yourselves that ye are the children of them which killed the prophets. Fill ye up then the measure of your fathers. Ye serpents, ye offspring of vipers, how can ye escape the damnation of hell? Wherefore, behold, I send unto you prophets and wise men and scribes. And some of them ye shall kill and crucify, and some of them shall ye scourge in your synagogues and persecute them from city to city, that upon you may come all the righteous blood shed upon the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel unto the blood of Zacharias the son of Berechias, whom ye slew between the temple and the altar." In carrying on to its conclusion the conspiracy originated by their ancestors, these wicked people also take upon themselves the responsibility from the beginning to the end. Even they recognize this, for in Matthew 27, verse 25, when they condemned Jesus Christ, they acknowledged it, for there we read, "Then answered all the people and said, His blood be upon us and on our children." So the book of Revelation, opening up the future to the time of the end, shows how this judgment finally comes upon them. Going on to chapter 20, we again find Israel in the picture, for we read, "And I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given unto them." This is the very thing of which Jesus Christ spoke to his disciples in Matthew 19, verse 28, when he told them, "Verily I say unto you, that ye which have followed me, in the regeneration when the Son of Man shall sit in the throne of his glory, ye also shall sit upon 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel." This is not the judgment of the wicked, for Jesus Christ has already executed judgment upon the Babylonian system and the beast nations in chapter 19. And the final judgment of the wicked, which comes after the end of 1,000 years of Christ's reign and the second resurrection for judgment, this is conducted by God, not by men. So this reference to some sitting upon thrones and being judges refers to the disciples being judges over Israel. Rule by judges is an old Israel institution, as the book of Judges in the Old Testament sets forth in detail. So the book of Revelation shows that this Israel institution is in effect again during the millennium. We should not be surprised at any of this. God was right even from the beginning. He chose his people Israel forever to be his servants and to show the world how glorious his rule can be. While some individuals, by their misconduct, have failed to secure this glory for themselves, yet they cannot frustrate God's will. In Isaiah 43, verse 21, God says, "This people have I formed for myself. They shall show forth my praise." The book of Revelation shows that they do so, even into eternity. But this has taken all of my time for today, so we'll finish this subject in my next broadcast. Today I want to conclude our study of Israel in the book of Revelation. In my last three broadcasts, we have been studying the book of Revelation. This book has puzzled scholars for many centuries because its prophecies are so obviously written in symbols, and you cannot make head or tail of it unless you can understand the symbols. Because most churches have been guilty of the false and pernicious teaching that the Jews are Israel and that God had abandoned his entire religion as set forth in the Old Testament and started a new and different religion with Israel left out of it. Because of this, The book of Revelation has been a closed book to them. They have deliberately rejected the keys which would unlock its mystery. The fact that its symbolism is not new, but taken from the Old Testament, where it deals with God's people Israel, who are and have been Christians through most of the time covered by this book. It uses old, well-established Israel symbols. And where it deals with the others, the beast nations, most of its symbols connect with those used in the book of Daniel. This book prophesies 3,000 years of history, of which the first 2,000 years are already past. It is far too big a subject to cover in its entirety in the time I have available, even if I were able to clear up all its mysteries. But we have undertaken to point out the Israel symbolism used in it, and to show where the things prophesied are confirmed by some other prophecies and by known history. So let's resume our study. We had started on the 20th chapter, which deals with the millennium, the thousand-year reign of Jesus Christ over the kingdom of God. We saw that during that thousand-year age, Jesus Christ rules the Gentile nations with a rod of iron, compelling them to live by the laws of God. This had been prophesied in the fourth chapter of Micah, where it says, "And he shall judge among many people, and rebuke strong nations afar off, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up a sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. But they shall sit, every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts hath spoken it." Even men who like to think of themselves as religious have thought that they can bring this to pass by their own wisdom and power, through alliances with Satan and the United Nations, where all mention of the name of Jesus Christ is forbidden. But no good can ever come from a godless source. Disarmament and peace can come only when the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken it, not when it is spoken by Johnson and Ho Chi Minh, by Mao Tse-tung and Rostov. The Gentile nations have lived under their own rule, according to their own ideals, for 6,000 years. 6,000 years of continuous tyranny and cruelty, poverty and disease, misery and filth. They have rejected the laws of God, so they must receive the consequences of their own choice. Proverbs 1, verses 29 to 31 tells it. "They hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of Yahweh. They would none of my counsel. They despised all my reproof. Therefore shall they eat of the fruit of their own way, and be filled with their own devices." But during the millennium, they will be compelled against their will by a rod of iron to live in obedience to God's laws, and they will see that peace and prosperity result from it. Yet they will not be convinced, for it is not in their nature to understand it. Jesus Christ explained all this to his disciples in the 14th through the 17th chapters of John, when he said, "And I will pray the Father, and he shall give you another Comforter, that he may abide with you forever, even the Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive, because it sees him not, neither knows him. I have manifested thy name unto the men which thou gavest me out of the world. Thine they were, and thou gavest them me. I pray for them. I pray not for the world, but for them which thou hast given me." This is exactly what Micah had prophesied. For in the very next verse after those which I quoted to you from Micah, telling of the great peace the nations would have under the personal reign of Jesus Christ, Micah goes on to say this, "For all people will walk, every one in the name of his God, and we will walk in the name of Yahweh our God forever and ever." So don't expect the other races and nations to be converted, even during the millennium. The need is not for sending missionaries to Africa. The need is for sending missionaries to the Methodists and the Baptists. Accordingly, we read in Revelation 20, verses 7 to 9, "And when the 1,000 years are expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison, and shall go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. And they went up on the breadth of the earth, and compassed the camp of the saints about in the beloved city. And fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. Against whom do these Afro-Asian nations make war? The saints, it says. And who are the saints? Psalm 148, verse 14 tells us, who all the saints are, not just some of them, but all of them. He also exalts the horn of his people, the praise of all his saints, even of the children of Israel, a people near unto him. Finally, the 21st chapter of Revelation describes the Lamb's wife, the New Jerusalem, the city of God's people. Here again, many churches have taught false doctrine because they would not take the trouble to study the Bible, but only their own doctrine. Before it is too late, they should remember that Jesus Christ himself quoted those terrible words from Isaiah, "In vain do they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men." They distort the whole Bible, trying to apply all of God's promises to their church. Some of them teach that Christ's bride is the church. They never got that out of the Bible, which teaches plainly that the church is Christ's body, as Paul says in Ephesians 1, verses 22 and 23, "and hath put all things under his feet, and gave him to be the head over all things to the church, which is his body, the fullness of him that filleth all in all." No one marries his own body. Christ's wife is his people Israel, as the Bible shows in many places. For example, Jeremiah 3, verses 12 and 14. "Go and proclaim these words toward the north, and say, Return, thou backsliding Israel, saith Yahweh, and I will not cause mine anger to fall upon you, for I am merciful, saith Yahweh, and I will not keep anger forever. Turn, O backsliding children, saith Yahweh, for I am married unto you." Again, in the 54th chapter of Isaiah, God says to Israel, "Fear not, for thou shalt not be ashamed, neither be thou confounded, for thou shalt not be put to shame, for thou shalt forget the shame of thy youth, and shalt not remember the reproach of thy widowhood any more. For thy Maker is thine husband, the Lord of hosts is his name, and thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, the God of the whole earth shall he be called." The description of the holy city, the New Jerusalem, given in the 21st chapter of Revelation, again shows that it is God's people Israel. It describes the foundation of its walls, naming the stones of which it is made. These are the precious stones which were set in the breastplate of the high priest of Israel. Also, it describes the city as surrounded by a high wall, saying, "And had a wall great and high, and 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, and names written thereon, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. On the east 3 gates, on the north 3 gates, on the south 3 gates, and on the west 3 gates." As we have seen, this is the familiar hollow square of the camp of Israel, with 3 tribes camped on each of the 4 sides. But in this final city of God, set up for all eternity, note that it is surrounded by a high wall, so that nobody can get in except through one of the gates, and these gates are the 12 tribes of Israel. In chapter 22, verse 14, it says, "Blessed are they that do his commandments, that they may have the right to the tree of life, and may enter in through the gate into the city." So never let anyone tell you that the Jews are Israel, or any part of it, for we have often proved that they are not. Never let anyone tell you that God has cast off his people Israel, for he is not. The whole Bible is an Israel book, commencing with its first book, Genesis. And we have now seen that even the last book, that of Revelation, is also an Israel book, not only through all of this age, but also throughout all eternity.